Some of us really like surprises, and some of us really do not. Think about the times you've yelled surprise at somebody's birthday party, and the times among those when the person being celebrated didn't look quite so happy. But surprise is good for us. So says today's guest. Tanya Luna is the co-author with Leanne Renninger of the book Surprise, Embrace the Unpredictable and Engineer the Unexpected. Tanya Luna heads the culture department at Life Labs New York and is the co-founder of Surprise Industries, a company specializing in surprise. She conducts research on surprise and writes for Psychology Today. Leanne Renninger is the CEO and founder of Life Labs New York. Tanya Luna, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. So excited to be here.
So you created a job for yourself. Sounds like you created a whole field, too. Surprisology?
Yeah, well, surprisologists have been around since the 1800s, it turns out, which are basically just people who've gotten obsessed with studying the science of surprise. But yeah, for the past 7 years now, I've been researching surprise, designing surprises for people, and now with Life Labs, finding ways to weave surprise into learning.
So how did you get started with Surprise Industries?
Oh boy, it was kind of odd. My sister Kat and I were usually we don't get along. This is one of the few days we were getting along, having a pleasant conversation. We came up with this idea for a business, and the idea was people sign up for an experience and they don't know what it's going to be until they get there. And so for me, it really appealed to me because I've always been entrepreneurial. I really like new experiences, and I have always liked surprising other people. Previously hated being surprised myself. So I thought it would be really fun to surprise others. Didn't realize that this would take me on this whole journey of, you know, becoming really interested in surprise and how it plays a role in my own personal life.
So what's a typical workday like at Surprise Industries, if there can be such a thing as a typical workday?
There's no typical workday. I mean, so most of my time I spend with Life Labs, where we do training for companies, and we're always finding ways to add surprise there. But with Surprise Industries these days, the biggest thing we do is something we call the experiment. So we collect, basically people fill out a questionnaire on our website, and they tell us all kinds of things about themselves, and they agree that at some point in their lives we might surprise them. And so every once in a while I get together with a group of like-minded surprise lovers, and we look through this directory of people who have told us that it's okay to surprise them, and we come up with ways to surprise them. So it could be really small, like having someone make an anonymous phone call or send a letter, or it could be large, like, you know, sending someone on a flight lesson, or it could be inviting someone to step outside and then we blindfold them and there's a car that takes them to a restaurant where they get to meet someone that they've always wanted to meet. So it's all over the board. There's no typical day.
And so, I mean, how do people indicate the kinds of things that they're willing to be surprised by? I mean, so that you don't get into a situation, for example, you're triggering somebody's phobias or something, and getting them in a limo with a clown or something.
Yeah, that would be awful. So one of the things that I've learned through Surprise Industries, and you know, it's gone through so many different iterations, it's been very, very experimental. What we've learned is that surprise isn't created equal for everyone. And it might seem really, really obvious, but it was kind of surprising to us the extent to which something that's pleasant for one person will be really unpleasant for someone else. And that's kind of life lesson number one for me, is when you are surprising someone, you have to be so careful to know what they like and what they dislike and what they're scared of and what they're excited by. So with this questionnaire and with any other surprise we've designed in the past, we find out what's their comfort zone, what's right outside their comfort zone, what's far outside their comfort zone, you know, what allergies, restrictions, phobias do they have. So we always find that kind of stuff out. The idea is pleasant surprises only. We want people to get excited about surprise, not try to, you know, avoid it from now on.
Do you have, like, different payment plans? Like, can somebody sign up for a quarterly surprise or monthly surprise?
We used to do surprises that were paid. So there were we did surprises for couples. We did surprises for companies. We had some companies that we would send a surprise to every month. Now that I'm spending the majority of my time with Life Labs, the experiment is completely experimental, and people pay $1. So every single person that signs up pays $1. At this point, we have 170 people signed up, and we're just paying for the surprises ourselves.
So it really is a psychological experiment now. It's not
exactly.
It's not a business model so much anymore.
Yeah, exactly. We'll see what happens business-wise with Surprise Industries. But my business time is now spent at Life Labs, but my sort of quirky experiments happen at Surprise Industries.
So readers will be struck by your own reaction to surprises from fairly early in life, it sounds like. You were allergic to surprises, is what we set the billboard for this hour.
Yeah. Pretty much until like year two of Surprise Industries, I hated Surprise. I mean, I was really surprise averse to the point that even when I was a kid, I didn't let even my parents give me surprise gifts. I have like a ban on surprise birthday parties.
You had like a 1 week approval on your birthday gifts? Is that what I read?
Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty extreme.
That's crazy. Pretty extreme. Yeah, I used to, my favorite, this is, again, so you know, like, what goes on inside my brain. So the teenager version of me, my favorite piece of jewelry was this flash drive I used to carry around my neck where I had spreadsheets with all of my plans. So I'd say, like, these are my plans for the month, these are my plans for the year, 5 years, and so on. So it was very much a control freak.
Wow. And did you accessorize, though? I mean, did the flash drive come with nicer chains or something? Or was there an evening flash drive and a daytime flash drive?
Oh, I wish I had that idea. I no longer wear the flash drive, but now I'm tempted.
Wow. So tell us about meeting Leanne and putting your heads and your projects together.
Oh, that was, again, really surprising. You'll get sick of the word surprise by the end of this hour. But, Leanne had started Life Labs, which is training for life skills and skills that you don't get a chance to learn in school. So how to ask good questions, giving feedback, problem solving, things like that. And she had done research on surprise accidentally as part of her PhD. So what she found in her research by looking at micro expressions is that people's favorite memories almost always have an element of surprise.
We'll pick it up there on the other side of a break. Tanya Luna visited in 2015 to talk about her book, Surprise, Embrace the Unpredictable and Engineer the Unexpected. It should come as no surprise to hear that the interview will continue on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. The person you thought would be there wasn't, but someone else was, and you became great friends. That's an example of how we take advantage of surprise. And it turns out there can be many benefits to being surprised. Tanya Luna conducts research on surprise and co-founded a company called Surprise Industries. She and partner Leanne Renninger wrote a book, Surprise, Embrace the Unpredictable and Engineer the Unexpected. Back we go to 2015. So we were talking about how you and Leanne put your heads and your projects together and came to this realization that a lot of people's happiest memories involved surprise.
Yeah, so for Leanne, her introduction to surprise was in the laboratory. So as I was mentioning, she was studying microexpressions, and she was looking at people's microexpressions as they talk about their happiest memories. And she found that whenever people describe their happiest memories and they experienced authentic happiness, which isn't just like a contentment, but this deep joy, they almost always described a memory that had an element of surprise. It didn't even have to be a positive surprise. It could be something awkward happening on someone's wedding day, for example, but that allowed them to fully relive that memory. So that's how Leanne fell in love with surprise. She, several years later, decided to create a workshop on surprise called Surprisology. She tried to buy the website, surprisology.com, and I owned it. And so that's how we found out about each other. First day we met, got together, had bubble tea in Brooklyn in New York, and that day decided we had to write a book together, we had to start teaching together. And ever since then, we've just been obsessed with finding out more about surprise and how to share what we've learned with others.
You mentioned that the term surprisology has been used, I think, since the 1830s, but it sounds like we're just now beginning to get a real handle on what it does for us.
Well, so surprise has been studied as a science since the 1800s, but surprisology, the word, mm-hmm. I think, is ours.
Ah, okay.
I'm pretty sure they didn't have quirky words like that in the 1800s.
Probably not. So in addition to meeting Leanne and deciding that you guys had to work together, it sounds like somewhere in this general period of time, that this is also the time that you met the man who became your husband.
Yeah.
And how big a leap did that require taking in your life away from your risk-averse self?
Yeah. How do you know so much about me, Jeff?
You wrote a book.
That's what happens when you write it in a book. I met Brian just as I was starting the business. This was when I was still in my, like, control freak kind of mode. Brian is very much a feeling kind of person. So he's always been, you know, big on, like, just feel it, you know, don't worry about it, don't put words on it, don't try to predict what's going to happen, just be in the moment. And I was like, what is that? What are you talking about? How do you do that? And so with him, along with the business starting to pick up, at that point Surprise Industries, and we were starting to get orders, and it was just everything in my life had become so unpredictable. And part of my realization with Surprise is that when it comes to emotional vulnerability, the reason that we kind of protect ourselves and don't allow ourselves to trust or to fully feel something is because we're scared of surprise. We're scared of something unpredictable happening and not knowing how to respond to it. So with the business, as well as with Brian, it's been very much about letting go of control and being excited about the surprises instead of feeling like I have to prevent them from happening.
So and I think that's a fairly standard thing, I would assume, that in insulating ourselves from the bad surprise, we also cut ourselves off from the good surprise.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's essentially like a kind of emotional numbing that we do. So one of the interesting areas in research and surprise is that surprise is an emotion intensifier. So it intensifies our emotions by about 400%. And that's a statistic from a researcher named Wolfram Schultz, who is looking at dopamine and how it's impacted by positive and negative surprises. So surprise is this addition to our emotion. So if it's a positive experience and it's surprising, we're going to feel it so much more intensely. But that also means that negative surprises will feel that much more unpleasant and painful than if we had seen them coming. So it makes sense that our brains try to prevent the negative surprises. It's just that we also accidentally prevent the positive ones too.
Is there, Tanya, a definition of surprise?
There is, yeah. I mean, researchers really, since the 1800s, have been pretty perplexed by it because it's not clear if it's an emotion or an emotion intensifier. But the two areas that researchers agree on is that surprise is either something unexpected or misexpected. So your brain is this prediction machine. It's constantly trying to decide what to do in the next moment based on its assumption of what's going to happen next. And surprise is every time you're wrong. So your brain has to pay a lot of attention to that moment.
And you do describe a surprise sequence in here where it sounds like you have to figure out what kind of surprise you're dealing with. It's probably part of that.
Yeah. So one of the things that Leanne and I realized in really starting to explore what happens in the brain when we're surprised is that it's not just one thing. It's not this moment of surprise. It's this whole series of things that happens. And that's one of the reasons I think researchers have been a little confused, is because some of them research one phase of surprise and others research another phase. So in putting it all together, we say there's freeze, find, shift, share. The first thing that happens is that first moment of surprise, a schema discrepancy, a discrepancy of what you were expecting to happen. And your brain just essentially, all of your attention gets hijacked by that surprise, and you're only paying attention to that moment. And there's literally this kind of freeze that happens for about 1/25th of a second where you're not paying attention to anything else. Next thing that happens is the find phase. So this is where you get hyper curious and you start asking questions, either literally or just in your head, trying to figure out what happened. Then shift is where once you figure out what it was that happened, you have to change your perspective. Like if I have a particularly strong opinion about dogs, let's say I don't like dogs, and then I meet a dog that's really friendly, that's surprising, and I'm going to have to shift my perspective on how I see dogs as a result. And then finally, share. So surprise creates what psychologists call this cognitive burden in our brains. It's so cognitively hectic that we essentially are kind of tense, and we try to relieve that burden by talking about the experience to others. So that's why when you have a surprising experience, you usually can't wait to talk about it or tweet about it or, you know, pick up the phone and tell someone about it.
Blab it all over the place, for sure.
Exactly,
that's the share
part.
Yeah. A couple of terms I want to get into here. We'll get the schema discrepancy in a moment, but P300 wave, is that the term you're using in here?
Yeah, exactly. So essentially, it's this brainwave that is the neural alert that hijacks all of your attention. So it works with surprise, it works with suspense. Usually our attention, especially these days, is so fragmented. We're paying attention to so many different things at the same time. The P300 is like it essentially goes around, grabs everything, pulls it all together, so all of your attention is fixated on the thing that's surprising or suspenseful, meaning that it might surprise you.
Okay, so and then the other term was a schema discrepancy. So you come up with, I mean, you have sort of a frame of reference for things, and if the surprise is different from what you're expecting, then you have to shift that frame a bit. That's the discrepancy against your schema.
Exactly, and it could be on a really small scale. So it could be like, oh, I didn't know there was coffee in this neighborhood. Or it could be, and this is where surprise gets really exciting, it could be on a really deep level. You know, it could be like, oh, I thought I hated people of this particular ethnicity, or I thought I didn't like people of this age group. So if you have a particular way of looking at individuals, a way of looking at the world, surprise is one of the only things that could change the way that you currently see the world.
Really? So does that makes it sound like you can't really learn your way out of thinking differently about something so much as being surprised by something.
Yeah, that's what the research shows, that essentially one of the what we used to believe is that learning happens through repetition. In fact, there's a lot more research, a lot more convincing research that shows that while repetition can help memory, when it comes to genuine learning, where you're starting to explore and learn about your environment and ask questions and integrate it into a new way of thinking, even starting with babies, surprise is that neural alert that tells you this is important. You have to pay attention to this thing.
Okay, so the moments when you're in school or in any sort of learning environment and you think, oh, that's what that means. That's
right.
That's that moment of surprise that really knocks it into your head a little harder.
Yeah, and if you think about school, I don't know what your experience was like, but for me, I don't remember a lot of those moments. So, you know, I think that that's also an area where it's important to think about surprise, because for the most part, school isn't designed around surprise, even though those are the moments that we think back on and we're like, oh, yeah, remember that weird thing happened and I learned this thing that I'll now remember forever.
The book is called Surprise, Embrace the Unpredictable and Engineer the Unexpected. Tanya Luna co-wrote it with Leanne Renninger, and Tanya is our guest on The Exchange. Why is Jean Piaget considered the father of surprisology, as you put it in the book, Tanya?
Well, I don't know if anyone else other than Leanne and I call him that, but Jean Piaget looked at learning in children. He's kind of known among psychologists as the founding father of learning, and he was the first, as far as we could tell in literature and psychological literature, to really talk about the importance of surprise. So he introduced the concept in psychology of a schema. So he said, you know, when kids are learning, essentially in order for learning to happen, you constantly have to stretch their schema. He introduced these concepts of assimilation and accommodation. So every time something happens that we expect, our brains almost pay no attention to it. It's like it's invisible to us. When there's some sort of discrepancy, then he would say our brains have to accommodate. They have to change the way that they're, you know, framing ideas or concepts so that they can integrate this new concept. It's like, you know, I always think about it as, Jeff, you're from New York City, is that right?
Originally, from the suburbs, yeah.
Okay, all right. So have you ever been on a crowded subway in New York or a train? So accommodation is kind of like when everyone has to squeeze in and move around so that someone new can get on. So that's what the effect that surprise has, changing things around so that you can have this new way of looking at things.
Huh, it really does have to kind of force things around, it sounds like. The schema discrepancy shoves things around pretty hard.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So what did Jean Piaget figure out about the relationship between surprise and age? Are we much better at this as when we're younger?
Yeah, great question. We tend to get worse and worse as we're older. So our schemata, plural, becomes more and more rigid. So this is why kids, you know, they're so open to things. They touch things, they sniff things, they put things in their mouths, and you're like, oh my God, why are you doing that? As an adult, you become much less receptive to trying new things. We even have this bias where it's called the confirmation bias, where we, without even realizing it, ignore information that challenges our beliefs, and we seek out information that confirms it. So up to a certain age, we're constantly seeking out surprise, and then past, you know, even like early adulthood, we essentially start avoiding surprise for the most part. I mean, of course, there's exceptions to that, and we do seek out new experiences, but it becomes less and less comfortable.
It seems like we do seek out surprises, and maybe I'm lumping too much in the category of surprise, but we do see scary movies, we do bungee jump, we do things where we have some idea that there's going to be something surprising to it, but we don't quite know the extent of it when we get in.
You're right. There's a concept in psychology called juicing the machine, which is this idea that as human beings, sometimes we just like to feel things. So oftentimes life will be so safe and predictable that it just sort of feels like meh. And so we seek out, why do we pay money to be scared or to cry? I mean, laughing makes sense, but crying and being scared. So, yeah, you're right. But to some extent, we do try to course correct and make up for our lack of surprise in life by looking for kind of often recreational versions of surprise. So maybe we don't want to challenge our beliefs, but yeah, maybe we'll go bungee jumping or at least try new food at a new restaurant.
Something with jalapenos in it. Let's take a call. Here's Jacob in Springfield, Oregon. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tanya Luna, the co-author of Surprise.
Hi, good morning. I guess I wanted to surprise you with sort of an alternative explanation. But imagine what happens when things go awry. There was this film a few years ago with Michael Douglas, directed by David Finch, called The Game. But it was a series of, you start with a wealthy, captain of industry, a banker, and he gets this surprise present for his birthday, and it's a game, and he kind of gets enrolled in it. And through the game, first it's kind of fresh and a surprise, then it starts becoming creepy, and he becomes paranoid, and he gets haunted, and they take away his wealth. They take away his social position. They socially embarrass him. And in the end, he kind of grows into madness. You see, but it's something that's sort of over the top. It's awry, but it's a surprise. It's a mistake. It's a mystery film that just becomes a horror film in the end when it goes over the top.
Do you remember how
what do you think about those awry cases?
I love the example of the game. First of all, though, I want to say at the end, I think the whole point is he learns a lesson. So I think he's like, oh, this is awful, but now I understand that I shouldn't be obsessed with wealth and materialism, if I remember correctly. That being said, you're absolutely right that you can go overboard with surprise. We think about this concept of a surprise seesaw, where if you have too much surprise, it triggers anxiety. If you have not enough surprise, then it triggers disengagement and boredom. So it's all about balance. I definitely think that whenever you're creating a surprise for yourself or others, whether it's trying to have a more enriching, surprising workplace or a more surprising relationship, you can definitely overdo it. You don't want to make people feel too out of control. I guess unless you're trying to really teach them the world's most intense life lesson like they do in the game, but I wouldn't go that far.
Right.
And I've been doing this a long time.
No putting people out of the streets, no.
No.
I can understand that people would fear the bad surprise, and nobody wants to get a surprise from the doctor, for example. But I mean, why do some people get to the point where they really avoid surprises like the plague, as apparently you once did?
I think it's going back to that surprise seesaw concept. When you have too much surprise and you have all this anxiety and uncertainty, you don't feel like there's something in your life that you can turn to for stability and predictability. I think that's when some of us go overboard. I mean, for me, my family moved around a lot. We moved to the U.S. when I was a kid, and we stayed at a homeless shelter for a while. We changed apartments all the time. So I think that the way that I coped with all that change was to say, okay, life is unpredictable. I'm going to predict and control as many things as I can. And that works. Sometimes when life is too unpredictable, you do need to find areas in your life, whether it's people or hobbies or habits, that create that feeling of consistency and security. The trick is just not to overdo it. So when you do find a little bit of that stable ground, to let go and start exploring with, unpredictability and uncertainty again.
You guys write that in wealthy countries, we have an unhealthy relationship with surprise, which sounds a little suspicious. What are we doing? What did we do wrong?
I think it's coming from a third world country myself.
Ukraine, we should point out.
Ukraine, yeah, which is, I guess, maybe now has been upgraded to second world.
Right.
But back then, when I was a kid there anyway, we didn't have quite as many surprise, we didn't have the same kind of surprise-related problems. We had other problems, bigger problems, but, for example, even things like being able to know the weather, you know, right before I was hearing the weather report. That's amazing. That's kind of magical if you think about it, that you know what the weather's going to look like tomorrow. Or, you know, being able to order in food, being able to order whatever you want online, having a smartphone that always tells you where you are so you're never lost. And that's amazing, but at the same time, it's really unnatural for our brains to have so much control. And so I think there are two responses to that level of control. One is that we, when things do go off track and when something surprising does happen, we freak out about it. You know, even the weather. It used to be that you would just carry an umbrella, and now if the weather report is wrong, your brain is dismayed about it. So on the one hand, we're not as good at handling surprise because in some ways we don't have as many surprises as we used to, small surprises. And on the other hand, I think we can get really bored too. So we often have unhealthy coping mechanisms for that.
Boredom and surprise can be two sides of the same coin. We'll explore that when we return to our 2015 interview with Tanya Luna, the principal author of Surprise, Embrace the Unpredictable and Engineer the Unexpected. Back with the rest of the interview here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Tanya Luna is a big believer in surprises and their value to us, mind and body. She co-founded a company called Surprise Industries, and she and partner Leanne Renninger co-wrote a book called Surprise, Embrace the Unpredictable and Engineer the Unexpected. Tanya joined us in May 2015 to explore the many benefits of having things out of our control happen to us. Here's the rest of the interview. So we're just talking about the sense of surprise, and then boredom gets in there too. But there's also a section in the book where you point out the exponential rate of change in technology and society. Do surprises have to be something that happens in an instant, or can they be sort of slow developing things like, gee, I'm surprised that my job no longer pays much if I work in a newspaper, for example?
Oh boy, yeah. I mean, there I think you're talking about kind of a combination of surprise and kind of anticipating surprise. You know, I think it's one of the scary things about working in an industry that's experiencing a lot of change isn't just, oh, I'm surprised that I'm not getting the kind of raise I wanted, which is a quick, you know, I just learned this thing.
Right.
And then there's the feeling of, I don't know what's going to happen. You know, like what is this whole industry going to look like 5 years from now, 10 years from now? So that's kind of the cousin of surprise, which is, I guess, uncertainty and suspense as well.
And we were talking about boredom, and you have this expression in the book, content zombies. That's really, really interesting. Tell us about content zombies.
This is actually a term made up by a student that I worked with. He was 12 years old at the time, I think, Zach. So he was explaining to me why kids his age, and I think this applies to kids our age as well. He was saying that, you know, we just kind of scroll through content. We're not really stopping to read anything fully. And so he said, we're content zombies. It's like, if you ever watch a zombie movie, one of the most frustrating things about a zombie is instead of just like catching one guy and having, you know, a good sized meal, they'll like take a chomp off, find someone else, bite that person, go to the next guy, bite that person. And so, you know, Zach was saying that we do the same thing when it comes to reading articles, you know, listening to the radio, watching movies, watching shows. We're just kind of clicking through it and consuming just little bits, and so we're never really getting ourselves to a point where we're full and satisfied because we're not digging in deeply enough to really get interested.
Does that dull the possibility of surprise then?
Yeah, exactly. So typically, surprise happens once we're paying attention. It's an interesting thing because surprise gets your attention, but typically once you pay attention long enough, you also start spotting small surprises. So surprise triggers curiosity, but curiosity also allows you to spot surprises. So when you watch something for a minute, or if you read something, you know, if you read a paragraph of something, or I don't even know if we'd read that much these days, like two sentences of something, you don't get to the good juicy parts, the parts that are challenging you to think a little differently, the punchlines, you know, the different perspectives. And that's the stuff that our brains are craving. We just don't realize that we have to pay attention in order to sort of start paying attention effortlessly. It takes a little bit of effort before the effortless part kicks in.
It's almost like we need to give time for the setup for the punchline to a joke, yeah, or for the payoff on a story.
Great way of putting it. Yeah, so it's like we're constantly listening to setups and not sticking around long enough for the punchline.
I wanted to ask about the mystery box at the Emotion Regulation Lab that you write about in the book. And first of all, the Emotion Regulation Lab is a scary name, but let's go on to what the... Yeah, it is.
I still remember, so I worked at this laboratory at Hunter College run by Dr. Tracy Dennis. The first time I went there, I saw the sign on the door, Emotion Regulation Lab, and I got so excited. And so I guess that was the control freak side of me that was like, you can regulate this stuff? Great! I never thought about it as being scary, but I could see what you mean.
But you were introduced to something there called the mystery box, and it's really interesting how people react to this.
Yeah, so one of the studies that I was a part of where I was a research assistant is I was wearing this very serious lab coat, and I'd have this big black box with a hole cut into the center, and we'd have three-year-olds and five-year-olds come into the lab, sit down with me. I had no facial expression, and I had to come up to them with this black box as we were monitoring their brainwave activity, their heart rate. And I would say, would you like to put your hand inside this box and find out what's inside? No facial expression, no vocal expression. And we were monitoring what went on in their brains when they were faced with this mystery box scenario. So did they put their hand in or not? How long did it take them? And most importantly, what was happening in their brains? So that was really interesting because, first of all, you could see that even the kids who stuck their hand into the box, they still felt this mixture of fear and excitement. And that's the thing about surprise. It's scary and it's exciting. And a lot of times your predisposition to surprise, your biological predisposition as well, it'll determine the extent to which you listen to the fear or you listen to the excitement. The kids that stuck their hand in, they were also scared, but the excitement won out. And the kids who stayed away from the box, they were also excited and intrigued that they always wanted to know what was in the box, but the fear won out.
So can we extrapolate this to a point where we're thinking if somebody thinks a surprise is going to be bad, they're often rewarded with the knowledge that, yes, it was?
Yeah, if you think that something is going to be unpleasant and then it is unpleasant, you're definitely going to feel less emotional intensity. So again, surprise intensifies our emotions. And so, yeah, you're reinforced in that way. That's how anxiety happens. Anxiety is your brain trying to predict the future. And so it's trying to soothe you by predicting the surprise away. The downside is that you're anxious and you're worried. And so what you gain in terms of a surprise that's not as surprising, you lose in terms of a lot of anxiety and discomfort leading up to the scenario. You also lose out because, as I've learned, even with bad surprises, when you really let them, just explore them, something terrible happens, something unexpected and unwanted happens. What we've seen from our research and in my own personal life, I've seen those instances are often some of our best learning opportunities, the best opportunities to, see what new doors have opened, see what new opportunities have been created as a result of something unpleasant.
So the surprise really hit me upside the head, but it turned me in a direction where I can see something differently.
That's a beautiful way to put it. Yeah, exactly.
Let's take a call. We have Sandy in Mount Shasta on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tanya Luna, the co-author of Surprise.
Yeah, hi. This is a great subject. I don't know anybody who has explored this other than Sylvan Tompkins, who I noticed that you referenced in your book a bit. And what you've talked about just now is kind of in the area what I was thinking about was surprise as an emotion. Tompkins kind of divided up emotions into nine basic foundational emotions, and some of them were negative, two are positive, and then surprise was what he called the resetting emotion. Mm-hmm. And it can go either way. It can go positive or negative depending on the nature of the surprise. And I love that you're relating it to curiosity and to interest, which interest was another one of the things he called a positive emotion, running on a range from interest to excitement. So I'm definitely going to be getting your book. And I love the concept of, what was it,
content zombies.
Yeah.
Content zombies, yes. Well, there's another zombie apocalypse to worry about.
Indeed. Thanks for that, Sandy. Good to hear from you. Okay.
Yeah, and Sylvan Tompkins, the researcher that you just cited, yeah, he's done some of the best writing on surprise, and you know, particularly that moment of resetting where all of your attention is now brought into the moment, so that you can focus on exactly what's happening. And that it is kind of affectively neutral. So that's why it's hard to know: is it an emotion or is it a cognitive state? Because you don't have a positive or negative experience with surprise until you determine whether it's a good surprise or a bad surprise.
Now, there's a whole section in the book Surprise on building resilience, and I'm curious to know how you find the line between building in some resilience to be ready for the things that surprise you if they're potentially bad, but how not to turn that into over-planning at the same time, to be too cautious.
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with what you said earlier about, you know, surprise knocks you upside the head, but you now look at the world differently. One of the things we've seen with really resilient individuals is that when something really bad happens, when a negative surprise happens, they reframe it. So they find a way to look at it differently. In the book, we talk about a woman who was diagnosed with cancer, and she had this amazing response to it. She said, "I've always wanted to know what I look like as a redhead." And so, you know, that's how she looked at chemo. That doesn't mean that she wasn't also in a great deal of pain and, you know, emotional suffering. And resilience isn't about not feeling negative emotions, but it's about having a balance of the negative with the positive. So you allow yourself to feel pain, but then you also go, okay, how can I look at this differently? It's also a matter of pivoting. So this is a concept that researchers have called post-traumatic growth. And this is actually a really fascinating area of research where the finding is that individuals who have gone through some sort of trauma, it seems to be the rule rather than the exception that they find that their lives are improved as a result of it. So in some way, and this isn't for everyone, but it looks like for at least 60% or more of the population, individuals who have gone through something traumatic find that it's opened up a new opportunity for them.
Which gets into the realm of reframing that you point out. You really just got to look at things a bit differently. But I love this other term. What's a struggle sandwich? What is that?
Struggle sandwich. So one of the things we noticed about people who are really resilient is that it's not that they're constantly succeeding or constantly struggling, but they're creating this balance for themselves. So we call a struggle sandwich. So basically it starts with, you can't start within some sort of difficulty right from the get-go. So let's say you want to get yourself to be really resilient when it comes to working out. So ideally you don't say, okay, I'm going to work out for 3 hours today, because you're going to struggle and you're going to have a terrible experience with it, and then you're not going to do it again. So ideally, you set yourself up for early success, some sort of small win. So one push-up, for example. But then you want to get yourself to struggle a little bit. So have some sort of challenging experience. So one push-up, and then maybe the next time I work out, it's going to be 30 minutes of something challenging. But the tricky thing here is that in order for resilience to really set in, you can't allow yourself to give up once you've given yourself the struggle challenge. So the struggle always has to end with some sort of win, some sort of victory. And when you create this pattern of success, struggle, success, it really becomes much easier for us to take on and handle struggle in the future. We essentially become classically conditioned or operantly conditioned to associate struggle with success. And so, for example, entrepreneurs who are constantly trying again and again, even despite a lot of failure, what's happening to them is that they have some small successes peppered in every once in a while, and that's the thing that keeps them going. So it's all about creating that right combination of struggle and success.
But it sounds like they need to be fairly close in time for you to be able to link them in your head or wherever this is going on.
Yeah, I would say that the struggle can last for quite a while, and as long as it's reinforced with some sort of something positive, then it's essentially the essence of addiction is random reinforcement. So you just want to use that to your advantage. So you want to randomly reinforce yourself with success. So if the struggle goes on for a while, but as long as it's eventually rewarded, we're going to associate that struggle with some sort of positive outcome.
All right. So I noticed that there's some reframing of your own in here. The vulnerability as strength thing. So open yourself up to new things, but yeah, vulnerability as strength seems like a bit of a dichotomy, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think, you know, and this has been, again, going back to like me having spreadsheets around my neck. One of the things I was trying to be is invulnerable. I was trying to like keep everyone out. One of the things we do at Life Labs is we work with a lot of rapid growth tech companies. what's really interesting about them is that they, I think, are pioneers in this vulnerable culture. So their CEOs, instead of being called sir or ma'am, they're being called by their first name. They're wearing jeans to work. They don't have corner offices. They're sitting with everyone else. They're telling jokes. They're sharing publicly what they're worried about, where they're failing. And that's, I really think we're changing as a culture in this direction of seeing leaders, individuals that we meet, companies as strong and trustworthy if they're willing to be vulnerable. So if they're willing to say, I was wrong, or if they're willing to say, I'm not sure about this, but I'm going to give it a try. You know, any sign of kind of emotional permeability, it seems that we're moving in this cultural direction of actually seeing that as a strength rather than a weakness.
So, Tanya, on a, I don't know, daily, weekly basis, I mean, do you advocate people trying to get surprises in, or, you know, say boo to people coming down the hall or something? but then how do you do that without becoming, oh, here comes the guy who's always surprising people?
I do make a habit of jumping out at people, but yeah, I wouldn't recommend that to everyone. But I would say, you know, it's all about seeing tiny opportunities for surprise. Just taking a look at your life and saying, where am I kind of a fortune teller? Where can I predict what tomorrow is going to look like? What this next thing that this person in my life is going to say? So any area where things have just become too predictable, too safe, shake things up a little bit. So it could be just asking a question that you don't typically ask. It could be, you know, you usually turn left when you leave the house. This time you turn right. And certainly you can, you know, challenge yourself more and go larger with it. But I'd say first start with the small surprises.
Surprise yourself, it sounds like, is a big one. I'm going to turn this way today.
Yeah.
All right, Tanya Luna is the co-author with Leanne Reininger of Surprise, Embrace the Unpredictable and Engineer the Unexpected. Thanks so much for joining us today, Tanya. Good to have you.
Thank you. This is really delightful.